Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the men that has been kind enough to share his intelligence with us from time to time, in altogether too long a time at that, but nonetheless in the past, and I'm very pleased to say today, is Dr. Tevi Troy. He is, among other things, a best-selling presidential historian. We're going to be talking a good bit about his brand new book, Fight House, Rivalries in the White House from Truman to Trump. Tevi is today an adjunct fellow at the Hudson Institute, but importantly, he has held senior positions in the United States government of great relevance to another topic that we are interested in visiting with him about, namely the coronavirus and what that entails at the moment and what it may involve in the future. He comes to that topic with credentials as the former Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. He also acted as the Assistant to the President for Domestic Policy and served as the Deputy Assistant. So in these roles, needless to say, he knows a thing or two about disaster management. In fact, he wrote a book on that as well, entitled Shall We Wake the President? 2 Decades of Disaster Management from the Oval Office, published in 2016. He's a good friend, a valued colleague, and I'm always pleased to have him as a guest. Tevi Troy, welcome back. Good to have you, sir. Let's talk about the coronavirus. Speaking of securing freedom, what do we think is going on? What can you tell us, Dr. Troy, about the nature of this virus? How dangerous actually is it?
Yeah, well, coronavirus is a new strain of flu that is affecting people in China and spreading around the world. As we know, we have more air travel and more travel around the world than ever before, and that is a problem. On the plus side, we in the U.S. And certainly in the Western nations are better at infection controls, at developing vaccines and having antivirals than we were, say, a century ago when we had the 1918 flu that killed about 50 million people around the world. So technology brings both vulnerabilities and also advantages and assets with it. In terms of the coronavirus, it is new, which is always frightening. It is about as deadly as the regular flu, which is to say, not incredibly deadly, but you know, there are still people dying from it. And also, it appears to spread a little more rapidly than the regular flu. So I would say it is a huge problem in China, a country that is not open about what's going on there, and then lack of transparency from government is a problem with these things, and also does not have the same kind of infection controls as we have. And so the Chinese government, as they want, is using repressive tactics to go after it. In the U.S., I'm not incredibly concerned about a massive spread of coronavirus here because we do have strong infection controls. We have a CDC that is very good at controlling this kind of thing. We know how to handle this kind of outbreak if it happens in the U.S. However, I do have real worries not only about how China's handling it, but also about its potential to spread in Africa, let's say, in the developing world. And as you know, Frank, the Chinese have spent a lot of time and effort putting a lot of resources and people into Africa over the last few decades. And so I'm really keeping my eye out on that situation right now.
Yeah, I want to come back to that. That is such a huge point, and it has gotten very scant attention, it seems, Tevi. Let me go back, though, to something you said a moment ago. Some of the things that we think we know about this disease and, you know, how deadly it is and how it's spreading, how contagious it is and so on, is a function of information that we're getting from the place where it most is at the moment, are we not? I mean, are we relying in some of those calculations on information that, as you say, the Chinese are not only notoriously not open, but, you know, dissembling or deceiving or otherwise unreliable? What say you on that?
It's a great point, and they are dissembling and unreliable. Both are problems. They're different problems, but they are both problematic. I tend to base my assessments on the contagion level and the fatality rates from Western scientists who are looking at this. It is true the Chinese are not giving us full information, but I do trust the Western scientists who are looking at this. At the same time, it would not surprise me if there are more cases than the Chinese have let on. And if you think about it, what they have done is they've quarantined a whole province of 56 million people, which is bigger than the state of California in terms of population. So they are doing things that the U.S. would never consider doing. And in fact, they may actually succeed in halting the spread through incredibly repressive tactics that we in the U.S. would never consider and would not be considered wise from a proper public health perspective.
There are reports that they are essentially utilizing sort of their social credit system, as it's called, this comprehensive capability to monitor, to surveil their population, reinforced perhaps by apps that are requiring people to, you know, provide them regular updates on their physical condition to essentially achieve that totalitarian control. And in addition, I think, to Hubei province that you're speaking of, Tevi Troy, there are cities that have essentially gone into lockdown, including Beijing. I mean, some of it perhaps the voluntary action of citizens who are terrified to go out. But you look at these videos of essentially empty streets in city after city after city. It's an extraordinary thing. So it brings me back to the first question. If we, yes, have some Western scientists who are making some informed prognoses on the basis of some data. When you were helping run the Department of Health and Human Services, when virtually all the rest of the information, the data, is at the Chinese hands, let's say, does it give rise to uncertainties about, for example, how we should consider the use of our infection controls if we're not entirely clear how long the disease incubates, how long it may indeed be incubating before individuals that have contracted it actually have symptoms of having contracted it? I mean, those seem to be disaster management challenges of the first order, are they not?
They are, and you may find this hard to believe, but in the SARS virus, the Chinese were actually worse. So the Chinese have gotten somewhat better in terms of, let's say, sharing virus samples. So we do have some information, and unfortunately, there are some victims of the virus who have made it to the West. So we are able to make some independent assessments on how viral, how contagious this disease is. But I think you raise a really interesting point with the social media scores that the Chinese have, which is an incredibly repressive tactic, not just in case of a disease, but in case of everyday life, right? I mean, if you're caught jaywalking through a camera, you're going to have trouble finding a mate and getting a job and getting into school. So, I mean, they really will tolerate things in China, or at this point, the people are tolerating things that we would never tolerate in the U.S. There's that great quote that the people are afraid of the Communist Party, but the Communist Party is also terribly afraid of the people. And as you well know, Frank, one of the things that led to the demise of the Soviet Union with how badly they handled the Chernobyl incident, with not being upfront with people, and people were getting information from Western sources. It's much harder to block those sources today, and the Chinese government is not getting good scores on how it's handling this. So it's having its own, I guess, social media score problem, and also this comes on the heels of the Hong Kong disaster for them.
Facing what's been called a biological Chernobyl of their own. Tevi Troy, we have to take a pause. We'll be right back with much more with the former Deputy Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services on coronavirus and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are speaking with the author of a terribly relevant book, Shall We Wake the President? 2 centuries of disaster management from the Oval Office. His name is Dr. Tevi Troy. He served close to the Oval Office for some years, acting as the assistant to the President for Domestic Policy and the deputy assistant in that role, and also as the deputy secretary for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. So who better to visit with about the coronavirus and what is going on both in China and perhaps elsewhere around the world, but its implications for us. Tevi, you were talking before the break a bit about what this is doing inside China and the possibilities that, as in the past, plague has contributed to the downfall of dynasties. The fear that the Chinese Communist Party has of its people is real and justified. Do you believe that there is this potential that their mishandling, their lies, their mistreatment of doctors who have been coming forward to tell the truth about the disease and the like could actually contribute to political ferment that might actually end this repressive regime in China? Your thoughts?
It is certainly something that you and I are not fans of the repressive regime there, and it's something to hope for. It's not something to count on. As you know, hope is not a strategy. We had great hopes in the Arab Spring that you'd suddenly see a flourishing of freedom, because people do want to be free innately. But we also have dictatorships with repressive tactics who are very good at preventing freedom. So I'm hopeful, but I'm not willing to predict that is going to happen. But there are certainly two really black marks against the Chinese government in terms of how they handled the Hong Kong situation and also how they're handling the coronavirus situation. And, you know, people who are in unfree situations may be able to cope with it day to day and recognize, okay, well, but I have my life and I get my food and I have my kids and all that. But once you have a situation that changes the dynamic, like you are having here, where you're having entire cities that are in lockdown, where you're having doctors who are being horribly mistreated for calling attention to the disease, then suddenly sometimes people get that spark where they are willing to take steps that they have been unwilling to take and unwilling to kind of upset the through line of their lives. So I'm watching the situation very carefully, as I know you are.
Let me ask you about Africa. You mentioned it earlier. There are millions of Chinese now in Africa, of course. Some of the countries in which they reside, they are engaged in various infrastructure projects like the Belt and Road Initiative. The countries in question typically are somewhat or even extremely dependent on China for, you know, the loans that they've been making or other, you know, contributions that they might be providing to the government in question, perhaps even exporting the social credit system technology to those countries. It seems as though at least some of them are continuing to allow Chinese to come and go from China at the insistence of the Chinese government. Given what we know, Tevi, about the dismal state in most African countries of their healthcare systems and the challenges involved in diagnosing this disease, especially against the backdrop of lots of other nasty diseases that the people of Africa suffer from, how acute would you say this could be as a new, well, continent on which we may really see pandemic levels of the coronavirus operating?
Yeah, this is where I have much more concerns than, let's say, coronavirus spreading in the U.S., where we do have good infection controls and we know how to stop and manage this sort of thing. I've been monitoring the Chinese presence in Africa for about a decade and a half. I remember I led a U.S. delegation to Zambia, and I was surprised at how involved the Chinese were in throughout the infrastructure and just helping build these nations. And the African nations are very dependent on the Chinese. So as you said correctly, they are reluctant to prevent Chinese folks who may be infected from coming to the countries. And we saw in the Ebola virus in 2014, Africa is not good at stopping these kinds of viral spreads, and they don't have the kind of infection controls, and they had to have massive intervention from multiple Western countries, including the U.S., which is building field hospitals there and trying to stop the spread of Ebola. So I worry about that toxic mix of Chinese involvement in Africa and Africa inability to stop disease spread and the contagion of the coronavirus. That could be really dangerous.
Let me ask you about an entity that I'm sure you've dealt with over the years, and let me just congratulate you for your perspicacity about the Chinese presence and the strategic implications of it in Africa. But a handmaiden for the Chinese, it seems at the moment, is the World Health Organization. It's headed up, I believe, by an Ethiopian who seems to evince much of that dependency relationship, shall we say, on the Chinese, and has been very assiduously trying to assure not to give offense to China by the pronouncements or recommendations of the WHO. What do you make of what the WHO is up to? You spoke highly of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, but what about this UN entity and the role that it's playing in the virus?
Yeah, you mentioned the UN. The WHO is basically the UN with doctors, which is a problem. But look, the WHO is a very political organization. They're very conscious of the Chinese and how important the Chinese are internationally and how sensitive the Chinese are. So, yes, they have been playing this not to offend the Chinese, which is a real problem. And they focus on things that are, I think, are of less import, and they are slow on this thing. You know, we also saw in 29 with the outbreak of the swine flu that the WHO and PAHO, which is the Pan American Health Organization, were just slow to recognize the development of the swine flu. These are large bureaucratic entities that do not move quickly. And in order to address problems like the spread of these diseases, you've got to be nimble and fast. And we don't necessarily see that from the WHO.
Well, that seems to be charitable. I have the feeling it may be worse than that if they are really supplicating themselves to the Chinese direction. But let me give you an example of one of the recommendations they've made is not to restrict air travel. And you said quite sensibly, Tevi, airplanes are not only a means of rapidly moving people from one place to another who may have this disease and suddenly they're in a different continent, including our own. But there's also the question of if this is a respiratory disease that is communicated through aerosol contact, incubation can take place massively in airplanes, can it not? And so what do you make of that recommendation by the WHO and the advisability of what the Trump administration is doing, which is ignoring it?
Well, look, it is true that this disease is problematic because you can be contagious before you're symptomatic, which is actually different than Ebola, because you are only contagious once you're symptomatic, and the symptoms of Ebola are so overwhelming that you basically were non-mobile once that happened. With this disease, you can be a spreader before it manifests itself, and that is a real problem. Look, I'm not one to ban all air travel. I think that is sometimes too big a step. But we do in the U.S. have a series of airports that have quarantine capabilities. And when I was Deputy Secretary of HHS, I would tour these airports, and you could go to that airport, and if there is a problematic flight or a worrisome flight, they could wall off that part of the airport, direct the flight to land in that section, and then they could assess the people there before letting them go throughout the country. I'm not sure you see that in other parts of the world, and that is something that is worrisome to me. So, I think the U.S. knows how to respond to this sort of thing, and I'm not sure that Africa and other developing nations are going to be as good at it.
Tevi, let me talk a little bit more with you about the Trump administration's response to all this. I know your counterparts in today's White House are very assiduously engaged in trying to figure out how to contend with this through restriction of travel, through quarantines and other measures. How would you rate how the administration is handling this problem as a disaster management problem, you know, that has to be, in part at least, run from the White House?
So far, it seems fine. I think you're better off in these things when the president kind of stays out of it and allows the professionals at CDC and FDA and NIH to do what they're supposed to do. And so far, we've been seeing that, and I like that. And I think the Trump administration has put competent professionals at the disaster management agencies within the U.S. government. We saw, for example, a couple of years ago with Hurricane Harvey. They seem to know what they're doing. The FEMA people were pretty good. So I think having less politics involved in this in general is a good thing. Because one thing I worry about in both Democratic and Republican administrations, if you get the political folks more involved, then the American people who are of the opposing political party will say, oh, well, I don't trust them because they're a guy I don't like, I didn't vote for. So the more you have the career professionals, the medical professionals out there being the faces of the response to this, the better off you generally tend to be.
Makes eminent sense. Let me just ask you about quickly one related subject. We only have 2 minutes or so before we have to break. China is the source, as you know, of now an extraordinarily large percentage of the medicines upon which our healthcare system relies. By some estimates, it's 80 or 90% of generic drugs or the ingredients for brand name prescription drugs. Almost all of our penicillin, even vitamin C. A colleague of ours, Rosemary Gibson, has written a terrific book on the subject called China RX. Again, your counterparts in today's White House are seized with this problem, it seems. How serious do you regard it?
Yeah, this is something that we looked at in the Bush administration when President Bush was rightly concerned about the spread of flu. And he said, we need to make sure we have alternative sources of developing our vaccines. At the time, most of the vaccines were being developed in Europe and manufactured in Europe. And he said, let's make sure we have the American manufacturers ready to respond to this. Sounds like a similar problem. You need to have American manufacturing capabilities of vaccines and antivirals so that if something bad happens, that Americans can get access to these. And you can't have a country potentially blackmailing the U.S. saying, if you don't cooperate with our repressive way of handling coronavirus, you won't get the vaccines that we're manufacturing for your company. So it is something that really needs to be monitored.
Well, I think monitored and addressed, needless to say. And it's also the concern about adulterating the drugs. You know, that's another kettle of fish, as they say. Tevye, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to turn to your newest book, just out, Fight House. We'll discuss the Trump administration, of course, but what its predecessors have exhibited in terms of internal discord and, well, dysfunctionality, I guess, is one of the fancy terms for it. That and much more with Dr. Tevye Troy right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are visiting with Dr. Tevye Troy. He is helping us work our way through a number of interesting topics. We've spoken to this point about the coronavirus and the challenges that it represents. I want to turn to the subject of his brand new book just out this week entitled Fight House, Rivalries in the White House, From Truman to Trump. It is a book about the infighting that as this highly acclaimed and accomplished presidential historian has established is not unique to the Trump administration. Tevye, let's talk a little bit about sort of what you have documented has operated in successive White Houses of both political parties, going back to Harry Truman's. And what are the sources of this discord that always takes place to varying degrees?
Yeah, so thank you, Frank, for bringing up White House, because I wrote this book in the last couple of years thinking about this issue of White House fighting and where did it come about. And obviously on some level, it's always been there. You always have infighting in any administration, and dating back to Washington, we see the famous musical Hamilton that talks about Hamilton and Jefferson at each other's throats in the Washington administration, but neither of them were White House aides. They were both cabinet members. And it is really only under the late in the Roosevelt administration that they undertake the development of a White House staff. It didn't really exist for all intents and purposes, before Roosevelt's administration. And Harry Truman is the first president to come into power with a White House staff in operation. And every president since then has obviously had a White House staff. And the White House staff changed the dynamic. You used to have a Secretary of State who was the constitutionally designated person or the duly constituted person to handle foreign policy. And now you had a National Security Advisor. And are those people in conflict? And does the fact that the National Security Advisor sits closer to the president mean that they have more power, more influence over foreign policy? And I argue in the book that that has led to more discord, more fighting, and in fact, also the development of the what I call the celebrity White House aide, somebody who is not what the original intent for a White House aide was supposed to be, someone with, like, quote, passion for anonymity. But now you have these people who, they may even have their own Twitter accounts while in the White House, but for decades now, we've had these White House aides who become celebrities and are well-known in the press and bandied about. George Stephanopoulos, we talked about in an episode of Friends in the 1990s when he was in the Clinton administration. So these people become household names in and of themselves, and that brings to it not only ego, but also sources in the press and friends in the press and more ability to leak and get your message out. So that, I think, has led to a development where you definitely have more infighting. And the three sources you were talking about, number one is if there's ideological discord within the White House. Number two is if there is a problematic process in the White House. And number three, if there's presidential tolerance for infighting. All those are the three levers that I argue are in a president's control to limit fighting in the White House if they so desire.
Let's give some examples of these three, because I, having served in an administration myself and having watched closely a number of them, as have you, it's obvious that these kinds of forces are at work. But just bring it home. An example of ideological discord that I personally was very familiar with was what was going on inside the Reagan White House, where you had Reaganauts, notably Ed Meese, butting heads incessantly, it seemed, with the sort of Republican establishment types, Michael Deaver and Jim Baker at various points, sort of prime examples thereof. When you chronicled this period, what was the basic problem there? Was it that there were these strong differences of ideological character and the president, you know, was aligned with one more than the other, I think, and yet was tolerant of the discord, it seems, didn't want to, you know, come down too solidly on one side or another. Have I got that right?
Yeah, I think the Reagan administration is actually the paradigmatic example of ideological discord because it reflected what was going on in the Republican Party. Now we think of the Republican Party as a conservative party, but at the time, you had the moderate Northeastern establishment. And there were Republican senators who represented that, you know, the Jacob Javitses of the world. And you also had a very conservative Republican Party that was emanating from the West and the mountain states and the South. And those two came together inside the Reagan White House. And that's why you had this ideological discord. You know, you mentioned Mike Deaver and listed him as part of the Republican session. Actually, he was part of the Reagan folks who came from California. He just chose to align himself with Jim Baker, who was the model of the Eastern establishment type, even though he came from Texas, but he was definitely a moderate, pragmatic Republican. And I think Deaver saw the way things were going. Unbelievably accomplished, who pretty much, as you know, and you probably, as do I, side with Ed Meese, who is a more committed conservative. But in many ways, Baker consistently ate Meese's lunch by leaking to the press about him and by outmaneuvering him, even in the tasks in which each of them had in the White House. They were supposed to be sort of co-equals, and Baker drew up a list of sets of responsibilities, and Meese basically had the ones that had more prestige, but Baker had the levers that had more power, and he used them very effectively to his advantage. Also, Meese, to his great credit, did not leak. He kind of declared unilateral disarmament, and he did not want to leak against Baker because he thought it was damaging to Reagan and the overall Reagan project, whereas Baker was happy to leak to advance his own interests. But I will say this, Baker was probably a more effective White House aide and helped get a lot of the accomplishments of the Reagan revolution through Congress and get them passed through the legislative strategy group, which is one of the groups that he headed within the White House. So I think that mix, while they're certainly fighting in that administration, and Peter Robinson, who's a speechwriter in that administration, said there was lots of fighting in the Reagan administration. We just didn't have Twitter, tweet, or twatter talking about it all the time. So the Reagan administration had a healthy debate about these issues and led to, I think, some very good results.
Interestingly enough, the practice of leaking for strategic purposes was, of course, not confined to the Reagan administration. You chronicle in your book, Fight House, Tevi Troy, the use that Colin Powell and Richard Armitage, his deputy, made in the State Department of leaks against Don Rumsfeld, their ideological and political, you know, counterpart and foe, I guess you'd say, who declined to utilize leaks. Tell us a little bit about that and its impact.
Yeah, I think this was a really fascinating episode because everybody knows or seems to know that Powell was a critic of the second Gulf War, the Iraq War. But Rumsfeld complained that I sit in meetings with him every day and he never says a word against what we're doing. He never criticizes, he never complains, he never tries to raise a different perspective. And what he would do, what Powell would do, was he might go along in the internal meetings, but externally he and his allies, specifically Armitage, would be leaking to the press that they have issues with it. And you and I talked a little bit earlier about how a fair process is one of the better ways to control infighting. Well, that's the opposite of a fair process. You sit around the table and you seem to agree on something, and then you go and leak to the press that you don't agree.
And of course, Armitage was the fellow who was the man who leaked information about Valerie Plame, which became such a huge problem for the George W. Bush administration late in its tenure. And to say nothing of for my friend Scooter Libby and others who were wrongly prosecuted for that case. Tell me about the practice of sort of strategic infighting dating back to the Kennedy administration. One of the interesting things, we hear a lot about Donald Trump's use of pejorative, you know, monikers, shall we say, nicknames, to deride foes and otherwise try to undermine them. Tell us a little bit about, Tevi, the research that you did into Lyndon Baines Johnson, versus Robert Kennedy, including nicknames that were in play there.
Yeah, this was actually fascinating. I loved all the nicknames that I found in Fight House, and if you go and purchase a copy of Fight House, there's actually an appendix where I list some of the best White House nicknames that were used over the last 50 or so years. But the Kennedy administration appears to be where it started, because Robert F. Kennedy disdained Lyndon Johnson, hated everything about him, and they had this shifting power dynamic between them, where in the 1950s, Kennedy was a Senate staffer while Johnson was an all-powerful Senate majority leader. And so Johnson had the power over him. But then once Kennedy becomes attorney general and the closest aide to his brother John F. Kennedy, while Johnson is sort of a weakened vice president who isn't given much to do, and Kennedy is lording it over Johnson. And then obviously once Johnson becomes president, then he's the president serving on top of a now less powerful attorney general in the form of Robert F. Kennedy. And the two of them would have nicknames for each other. And during the Kennedy administration, Robert F. Kennedy would dismiss Lyndon Johnson as Uncle Cornpone. Really, it was a very nice nickname. But then Johnson would call him the boy, and didn't think much of him either. And so the great thing about this rivalry is just how much Bobby Kennedy hated Lyndon Johnson. And there's a great quote that I have in the book in Fight House from Kennedy's father, which he said about Bobby, and he said it somewhat proudly: when Bobby hated you, you stayed hated.
Well, and I think it was fully reciprocated by Lyndon, as far as I could tell, for both Robert and John, as best I can recall. Let me ask you quickly about one particular nickname that I must say it really caught my eye. The one Barack Obama gave one of his top aides, Ben Rhodes.
Right. Well, to be fair, this was Rahm Emanuel who gave it to Ben Rhodes, but Ben Rhodes was a very young speechwriter who became Deputy National Security Advisor, and he had supposedly this mind meld with Obama, and he was much more critical of Israel than some of the older aides, including Emanuel, who wanted to have his child's bar mitzvah in Israel. And Emanuel nicknamed Rhodes Hamas, which is the name, as you know, of a murderous terrorist organization. And Rhodes doesn't shy away from this horrific nickname, and he even mentions it in his own memoir. Frank, as you know, I'm a big supporter of Israel, as are you. And I would be mortified to get a nickname like that, and I would certainly never put it in my own memoir. But Rhodes puts it out there as if it is a badge of honor, when it is indeed what you and I would agree is a badge of horror.
Indeed, and only one of the horrifying things of Ben Rhodes' tenure in the role of Deputy National Security Advisor to the President, including lying about the so-called Obama bomb deal that he helped engineer with Iran. Much more on that. Let's talk next, after a short break, Tavi Troy, about the Trump administration and how it measures up in Fight House. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for our fourth and final installment of this wonderful conversation with the author, most recently, of Fight House, Rivalries in the White House from Truman to Trump. Tavi Troy, again, congratulations on this new book. It is reputedly a very, very good read. I've not had a chance to do so myself, but I look forward to it. I wanted to give you a chance to talk a bit about the Trump presidency, which is much derided for, well, all manner of things, ideological discord, a flawed White House process, and a seeming presidential tolerance. It doesn't begin to describe it. It seems enthusiastic embrace of infighting amongst his subordinates. But you've demonstrated, I think, pretty compellingly that the administration may have all of those qualities, but it's certainly not unique in the extent to which they manifest.
The point, Frank, I would say, is just that Trump is known for using nicknames, but nicknames have been used throughout the history of presidential politics and throughout specifically the White House. And in that appendix in Fight House, where I do list all the nicknames, I find some amazing ones, including David Gergen, who served in four different administrations and had a lot of good ties to the press, was known as Professor Leaky because he would leak to the press so often. And you'll like this one in the Reagan administration, in that famous scene where Gergen is in the Situation Room along with Al Haig, who ran up the stairs to say, "I'm in charge here." Gergen excused himself a number of times from that room, and some of his colleagues speculated that he was excusing himself not to go to the bathroom, but to do another kind of leaking, meaning leaking to the press.
Three that caught my eye were John Kelly, the former four-star Marine general and chief of staff to President Trump, was given the moniker of the Church Lady by some of Trump's aides. Former Attorney General Jeff Sessions was derided as Mr. Magoo, and the former Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen was called, this is great, Nurse Ratchet. You've got to give credit where it's due. These are colorful and, if derisory, nonetheless, certainly capture some of the challenges that such folks represented. Let me turn to, if I could, the question of what it has meant to this particular president and the success of his presidency that he came to office with so thin a team of his own people. How would you characterize, maybe it's in the ideological context, I'm not sure, but the fact that, first of all, he was heavily dependent on Obama holdovers, and second of all, he seems to have turned over the keys to the personnel business to Reince Priebus and his minions from the establishment wing of the Republican Party. Do you think that those contributed significantly, Tevi Troy, to the difficulties that this president has had with the so-called deep state and, more generally, getting things done?
Well, look, when you staff an administration, you need to find something like 6,000 people to fill the various jobs, including something like 600 people for the top jobs, people who are the assistant secretaries and above. And a lot of those people don't make it through the staffing process. They don't make it through all of the various assessments and the checks and the vetting. So you do need to have a lot of people, and you need to think about that years in advance. The Bushes obviously had had years of people who had come around them, and they had these large networks. So I think that's sometimes a challenge. But the truth is, in White House, I don't get to do the deep dive on the Trump administration because I don't think we have access to the material that we will need to do a full assessment. With the Obama administration, for example, we talked about Ben Rhodes and his nickname Hamas. I did not know that and would not have known that during the Obama administration. That's something that came out afterwards. The Bush 43 administration, the administration in which I serve, the oral histories just came online in 2019, 10 years after Bush left office, which means, depending on what happens in the 2020 election, we'll have the Trump oral histories in 2031 or 2035. So it's hard to make a full assessment of what's going on in a specific administration while it's ongoing. And I just think I know so much more about the Obama administration from memoirs that came out after the administration. I think we will learn more about this administration in years to come. And in White House, I do the deep dives on the earlier administrations with full access to the archives and the oral histories and a lot of historical assessments that took place in the interim.
Well, this is, of course, an occupational hazard for presidential historians, isn't it? That you know that there's a lot that is not yet available to you and you have to make do. Perhaps the publication of John Bolton's book, I hope, after the election, will be something that sheds additional light for your purposes. There may be another edition of White House that will be required to get you, the documentation and the opportunity to digest it and share it with us. And I look forward to that, needless to say. And Tevi Troy, the other thing I wanted to ask you about, and again, this is not so much as an historian, but as a student of White Houses, has there ever been an administration that relied so heavily on family members for key official functions? And I'm not obviously speaking of the First Lady, that's a given, but I'm thinking of some of the other family members who are now prominently, talk about celebrity White House aides, prominently featured with extraordinary portfolios.
Well, the most famous instance of the family member is Robert F. Kennedy, who we mentioned earlier in the Kennedy administration. And there was, as we talked about earlier, there were real fights between Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. And the irony of this, as I mentioned in White House, is that these were two people who the president could not fire. Lyndon Johnson, because he was independently elected as vice president, and Robert F. Kennedy, because he was the Kennedy's brother. So you do have that challenge when you have family members working in administration for you. And so that I think that historical example is resonant here.
Yeah, it's resonant, but it's also one person, you know, in a cabinet level position, yes, but nonetheless not right at hand in the White House. And I'm thinking of, you know, specifically Jared Kushner as an example, a man who has had, to my best ability to reconstruct it, the portfolios for bringing about Middle East peace, you know, making government more efficient, managing the China relationship. And he, of course, has a new initiative underway as we speak on immigration reform. And the ideological, you know, factor that you've identified as one of the, you know, sources of discord in White Houses has certainly operated with him. Having a background more with liberal democratic associations, shall we say, and involvement in New York City, as did President Trump, you know, for much of his career prior to coming to the White House. And now, you know, is dealing with a president who has turned out to be fairly conservative in his governance. So, oh, and I forgot about criminal justice reform, too, among the other Kushner portfolios.
Yeah, I would say it's hard to predict where presidents are going to go when they come in. Sometimes they surprise you, and sometimes they act exactly as you expected, and sometimes it's a mix of both.
Well, this makes endlessly entertaining the job that you have of trying to help the rest of us understand what presidencies are about. And I want to thank you for not only taking a full hour to discuss some of the very important challenges that this particular president is confronting at the moment, but also talking us through the challenges that he and his predecessors have confronted in trying to fashion and conduct in a reasonably harmonious way the business of the presidency of the United States and the vital role that it plays, not only, of course, for us here at home, but for the rest of the world as well. Tevye Troy, again, congratulations on your new, highly readable, extraordinarily insightful, and directly relevant book, Fight House, Rivalries in the White House, from Truman to Trump. Go and get it, folks. Tevye, thanks. I hope you'll come back to us soon. We appreciate you so much. In the meantime, be well. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
Been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.